So this week I gave a title to the talk, I Can't Meditate, I'm Too Distracted. And I want to talk about this, first of all, just in the global sense of we're going through a time in the world and in our lives right now that is incredibly distracting. I mean, there's so much going on politically, the pandemic, environmental stuff that is getting worse and worse and worse. There's just, it seems like, how can I think about meditating? And first of all, I just want to say, now more than ever is a time we really need to practice. Practice is designed specifically for this time. So don't let yourself get tricked into thinking, oh, there's too much going on, I shouldn't be doing something else. You should be doing something else, but you should be meditating still anyway. Find time to do that. So that's on the global. But then, what about on the level of actually just sitting down to practice? And you get distracted. And so the first question is, I wrote a question down here. Why do we think things are distractions? Just like a ticking clock or someone in the room coughing or changing positions or a loud truck outside my window, because now everybody's practicing at home. You know, there's all kinds of stuff going on. You know, someone mowing their lawn right next door to you or whatever is going on out there, right? It's there's lots of things that seem like they're really distracting. And what I want to start with is just to see if we can reset how we see these things, how we see them, the fact that we see them as distractions is the problem. And basically seeing them as distractions usually indicates one of three unwholesome mind states has arisen. The first of these is restlessness. Restlessness is one of the kalesas. It's like, I just can't sit still. Every 30 seconds, I got to move. Or my mind is just jumping around like a monkey, you know, however you want to describe it. Right? It's just something, it's a mind state that arises. And when that mind state arises, we tend to start gripping a little tighter, mentally gripping, or maybe even physically gripping. And that makes anything external a distraction. Seems like, oh, that's why I can't concentrate, because, you know, that lawnmower is going there, or whatever it is. Another part of this from the mental problem state, I suppose, is we somehow think we have to have perfect conditions to meditate. Like everything's got to be just perfect. You know, it's got to be quiet. I have to have the right chair with the right kind of cushion. You know, my kids need to be quiet. You know, and so on and so on and so on. We get into this space of thinking we need to have everything perfect before we can successfully meditate. This is just a mental state. This is another unwholesome mental state. We're caught in wanting, looking for something perfect when nothing's ever perfect. Guaranteed. Just not going to happen. And often the other part of this is, especially if we're sitting with other people, but even where you are now, since we're all sort of sitting on our own, this is less likely to happen. But we end up judging other people for disturbing you. Oh, that person forgot to mute their mic, and now there's that sort of funny background noise of their dishwasher running while this Barry's giving his Dharma talk, or Barry while we're sitting. Whatever. We get caught in this sort of judgmental mind space of thinking it's their fault that I can't meditate. Because they're distracting me, right? Instead, what I'd like to suggest is that you just let the distraction, whatever it is, become your object of meditation. Remember the basic instructions of meditation are: whatever is arising, whatever is predominant in the mind, whatever is catching your attention, make that your object of meditation. Note that. So now, it doesn't make any difference what's happening. You know, I used to travel back and forth to Canada a lot. I had two elderly parents who were ill, and I was going back and forth a lot. And so I spent a lot of time in early morning shuttles from Boulder to the Denver airport. And I made it a practice to, as best I could, actually sitting on the airport shuttle, zipping down Highway 36 to the airport, meditating in the shuttle full of other people talking and talking on their cell phones and the guy playing his radio. I would do my best to sit there because perfect time to practice, right? It's early in the morning. It's like 6 a.m. or something like that. And I'm not doing anything else. May as well practice. So it's just like you have to shift your attitude in a sense to, oh, well, this is what I've got. So this is what, it's okay. Also, there's this really interesting thing that the Buddha says about this. And this is in the Satipatthana Sutta, the Buddha's instructions of meditation, there's a section called the refrain, which repeats over and over and over again. After every section of instructions, then the refrain comes along. And the wording changes slightly depending on which of the four foundations of mindfulness he's talking about. But basically, here's the most, what I think is really important. This is a direct quote. In this way, in regard to the body, he abides contemplating the body internally, or he abides contemplating the body externally, or he abides contemplating the body both internally and externally. What does this mean? Internally means your body, what you think of as your body. Externally, someone else's body. So you can abide contemplating the body internally, or you can abide contemplating the body externally. It's only we think that there's somehow a difference between my body and that other body or those other bodies. It's only when we see this separation, when we think in those terms, that we start blaming and judging. Otherwise, it's just, no one can disturb me. I sometimes let myself become disturbed. And that shift in attitude is what we have to make to, nothing can disturb me. I can only let myself be disturbed. And once I have that understanding and I just sort of take in what's actually happening as, well, that's what's happening, so this is what I'll pay attention to, then it's all fine. It's not like there's some things that aren't legitimate as things that we can focus on in our practice. You know, we don't, pay attention to the sweet and wonderful stuff and all that, you know, that loud lawnmower noise and the garbage truck crashing around in the morning or whatever it is, that's a problem. Sorry, no, it's not. We make it a problem. I want to tell you a story. This is from one of my long retreats. This is a retreat where most of the time I was doing most of all my practice either sitting in my room or sitting outside. But I was going to the hall, particularly first thing in the morning for the early morning sit, because I just love going to the early morning sit. There's an hour of sitting with 90 people. It's a very sort of energizing way to start the day. So where I'm sitting, about 3 spaces down from me, maybe 4 spaces, so fairly close. There's a hall with 90 people, so this person was fairly close. Was this person who coughed a lot. And, you know, I'd sit there and it'd be nice and quiet. And then she would come right at the very last second before the sit officially started. She'd sit down and almost right away she'd start coughing. and she would cough, and she would cough, and she would cough. And I was like so full of judgment. Like, what's wrong with this woman? Doesn't she know she can't stop coughing? She should, you know, sit someplace else, blah, 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 blah. I had this whole thing going on in my brain about it. And also at the same time, so I could, and I was noting the judgment. I could really see by the judging mind flying. And I also really noticed how she'd cough and then there'd be a pause. And it was like part of me got in really into waiting for the other shoe to drop. Oh, when I know another cough is coming soon. And so I was like sitting, instead of paying attention to the present moment, I was looking into the future, waiting for the next cough. And I saw that and watched that happen too. So, but it was, so I had the right attitude towards it, but at the same time, it was like, a lot of times I'd just be like gritting my teeth, like, oh, you know, really growling about it. So this was fairly early on in the retreat. And so as the retreat went on and she kept coughing, this shift happened, which was really interesting for me, where I started thinking things along the lines of, gee, you know, maybe she has lung cancer and she's dying. And this is her last chance to ever be on retreat. Or she has COPD and, you know, just can't breathe properly and coughs a lot. And so this whole energy of compassion towards her arose. And so instead of judging her, I let my heart open to her and feel for her. And also it's like, I know if I was in her position, I'd really be kind of embarrassed. And I'm sure she was too, because she's a long-term meditator. You know, there she was, but she wanted to be in the hall, obviously, and there she was coughing. And it was really interesting to see this shift in my mind from to this sort of sweet energy about the whole thing. Just replacing the unwholesome with the wholesome, which is one of the things I'm going to talk about later when I'm talking about the sutta we're talking about later on. But it was just fascinating to watch how my mind, same thing, same coughing, same person, it wasn't a problem anymore. It was kind of sweet, which was just fascinating for me to see that shift in my mind from one place to the other. So don't pretend that it's someone else's fault if you're distracted. I guess that's what this comes down to. It's just like life is full of things we think of as distractions, but if we really pay attention to what the Buddhist teachings say, you know, contemplate the body internally, contemplate the body externally, or both internally and so it's like be open to whatever's going on. Whatever's catching your attention, whatever's predominant in the mind, that becomes the object of meditation. That's the basic instructions on mindfulness. So there's nothing can distract us if we just follow the instructions. Just, of course, we get caught up in it all the time, but okay. So then there's another whole layer to this, right? Because often those distractions aren't external things at all. What's distracting is those stories we inevitably tell ourselves. You know, from either going back into the past and reliving something really pleasant, perhaps, or something unpleasant or whatever, or looking off into the future, either with this pleasant fantasy about how things are going to be so great once COVID-19 is over, or whatever our current level of concentration along that is, or worrying about the future. And these stories that we tell ourselves, because they are just stories, they're just mental arisings, are much more distracting often than external things, like a loud clock ticking or someone coughing or the lawnmower or the person next door, you know, all those sorts of external things. even if the story is kind of pleasant, you know, a sweet memory or a sweet future plan, it's always, there's always an aspect of unpleasantness to all of these stories, even the sweet ones. For instance, if you're remembering something from the past, then there's always this element of, yeah, but it's gone. It's not there anymore. You know, the kids moved out years ago, you know, or whatever the story is, right? Or if it's a future plan, then we want it now, but it isn't happening. I want COVID to end now. I want to never have to wear a mask again when I go to McGuckin's Hardware. Please let me stop doing that. Whatever, you know, I just don't want to have to do this, but it's still there. The stories are, and these stories are often incredibly gripping. So how do we deal with this? And typically there's a set of instructions that are taught in all retreats I've ever been on. At some point someone goes, does this thing, and there's an acronym called RAIN, R-A-I-N. And basically what we're to do is, first of all, the R in RAIN stands for recognize. In other words, be mindful. It's mindfulness that allows us to see that this is just that story. Sometimes that old, familiar, long-term running story has arisen. And when we're in that story, no matter what the story is about, we're no longer paying attention to the present moment. We're off fantasizing about the future, remembering the future, going into the past, blah, 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 blah. Long story. We've lost our connection to the present moment if we're not being mindful. Then, so that's the A. First of all, just see that this is what's happening. Really important. And often that's all you need to do. It's like if you really tune into the fact, oh, it's just that story again, often it'll just dissipate just like that. If it doesn't, however, now here's the second part. Accept. The A in RAIN is for accept. Be able to simply say, and that's okay, to not sort of blame yourself, not get caught up in, oh, I shouldn't have this story in my mind. I'm supposed to be meditating right now, right? But we need to somehow, no matter what the content, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral, nonsense, real actual memory of some horrible thing that happened to us in the past, we have to at some level be able to accept that it's okay. And I want to, Joseph Goldstein, in his book, Insight Meditation, wrote quite a bit about this. And I want to just read sections of this chapter because he expresses it quite well. Yeah. So he's talking about acceptance, and he also calls that relax. He says, we have to learn how to relax when these stories are running, right? The easiest way to relax is to stop trying to make things different. How often do we do that? Oh, I don't want this story. I'm going to make it something. I want something different than this, please, to happen, right? Rather than try to create another state, simply allow space for whatever is going on. If you sit down after being busy and your mind feels agitated or chaotic, just try seeing that state for what it is and accepting it. You might frame your whole mind-body experience with the mental note, chaos. Chaos. Instead of having an agenda to change the quality of your energy, you enjoy the use of this simple key to just open to the energy that is there. This does not mean either spacing out or being entangled in your agitated thoughts. Rather, through acceptance, we settle back into natural awareness of whatever is present. The meditative journey, huh? Here's the hard part, right? The meditative journey is not about always feeling good. Many times we may feel terrible. That's fine. What we want is to open to the entire range of what this body and mind are about. Sometimes we feel wonderful and happy and inspired, and at other times we feel deeply different aspects of suffering. It takes courage and determination to be willing to see all of these parts of ourselves. There are some dark corners in the heart that we may not have been willing to look at before or to explore. They will surely come up. Sometimes even the buildup of energy that happens in the practice can feel like an uncomfortable stretch. Such experiences of the unsatisfactory aspects of our life are all part of what meditation is about. Freedom cannot happen without them. The practice is opening, it is stretching, and most important, it is liberating. So we have to just accept, yeah, this is me too. This crazy story that I've told myself 1,000 times perhaps. It's me too. I in RAIN is investigate. For me, the most important part of this is when I find myself really caught up in some story in the mind, if I can, after I've recognized it and accepted it, as I then to investigate it, sort of try and drop out of the mind level into the body. Really tune into what does the body feel like right now? Like really consciously look at the body. Often you'll feel a lot of unpleasant body sensation because especially if the story is unpleasant, or even sometimes when it's pleasant, there's a lot of body sensation involved in these stories that is there. The beauty of this simple way to investigate is now you're not so caught up in the story. You've stepped back from the story in a sense. And now you're just paying attention to what's arising in the present moment in the body. Which is related to the story, is in some sense the result of the story, but it's not the story. We're not sort of caught in the details. We're not thinking about trying to somehow come up with a different answer than we came up the last 47 times when we told ourselves this story. Now we're just paying attention to what's actually arising in the moment. It's very simple, skillful way to shift these stories to the background. The story may not go away. And you may still be noting the story, but now the story's sort of in the background. It's sort of like watching a movie and you're just noting it, like, oh, there's that story. You know, noting the highlights, maybe, you know. But it's not like it's lost its grip because we're not twirling in the mind about it. Now we're staying in the body, staying really grounded in the body. And the power of that mental process just diminishes quite remarkably, actually. Mm-hmm. So the story just becomes another object of meditation. It's just another distraction. Like all distractions, just becomes the object of meditation. Oh, that story. I even have like notes in my noting practice for certain stories that are repetitious. Like, for me, the biggest one is planning. I'm a big planner. I'll sit to meditate, and I know I'm going to do a job at somebody's house that day, and I think, oh, I got to make sure I pack that tool and this tool and blah, blah. It's like it becomes a 30-minute planning session. And then, oh, there are 30s, you know, all of a sudden I wake up. I'm just caught in that story again. Okay, planning story. The end. This is the most difficult to grasp, but it's quite important, I think. The end stands for not self. We have to understand as best we can, note the words best we can, that these stories are how we create a sense of a separate self. That all these mind movies starring me are all I making and my making. This is how we create and maintain and encourage and amplify our sense of self through these stories. And so when we can see that that all they are is just stories, there's no self there, they're just stories, they lose their power, significantly lose their power again. It just seems, well, of course it's about me, because of course there's a self here, because the story's about me. It seems so obvious, like, duh. But actually, this is just the way we actually create that stronger sense of self over and over and over and over again, right? Retelling these stories. I'm the person who this thing happened to, or I'm the person who's going to do this thing in the future, or this thing's going to happen to me in the future, oh my God, or whatever the story happens to be. I want to read something from Bhikkhu Bodhi here. This is a wonderful definition of mindfulness that talks about this very idea. In the practice of right mindfulness, the mind is trained to remain in the present, open, quiet, and alert, contemplating the present event. All judgments and interpretations have to be suspended, or if they occur, just registered and dropped. The task is simply to note whatever comes up just as it is occurring, riding the changes of events in the way a surfer rides the waves on the sea. The whole process is a way of coming back into the present, of standing in the here and now without slipping away, without being swept away by the tides of distracting thoughts. To practice mindfulness is thus a matter not so much of doing, but of undoing. I think this is just a great description, that last line. The practice of mindfulness is thus a matter not so much of doing, but of undoing. It's just an excellent way to explain it. What Bhikkhu Bodhi's saying here really is we have to make sure that we sort of step back sometimes a little bit, that we don't get caught up in the details of these stories, and just step back and see them as stories and watch what's going on, noting it, paying attention to whatever's arising, and most predominant in the mind, that's what we pay attention to. And then something else is predominant, and something else, and something else, and that's all we're doing is paying attention. Now the unfortunate news, and the topic of tonight's sutta. And that's that sometimes, no matter what you do, this doesn't work. This whole idea of recognizing, accepting, investigating, and looking at the not-self aspect of things. Some of these stories are just so powerful. Some of these mental habits are just so powerful that this won't work. Or it won't work enough of the time. So now what do we do? What do we do now when we're just like, feel like we're just being run over by these stories over and over and over again? I'm drowning in these stories. We've all been there, I know. And there's an interesting thing that Joseph Goldstein, one of the times I was sitting with him, he said this thing that's always struck in my mind. It's very clearly, it's like, what great advice. Don't just pretend that you shouldn't rain on things. You shouldn't try this practice. You know, something unpleasant, especially with the unpleasant stuff, that's what we want to do right away. Oh, let's just, you know, we have to take these things in. But if we've actually consciously followed these instructions on rain, we've actually really paid attention and investigated them, and contemplated the not-self nature of them, and accepted them, and here it is again. And we've done that enough times. Then it's time to do something else. And that's change the channel. consciously choose enough already. I've seen this story. I've looked at it deeply. I've paid attention to it. Now it's time to change the channel. So this isn't what I'm going to talk about now isn't something we immediately go there. We try this first, the rain business first. See if that how that goes. But then at a certain point, it's like, okay, enough. And then we have to do what's suggested in the sutta, the removal of distracting thoughts from the Majjhima Nikaya, which is the sutta for the night. And this, I remember the first time I read this sutta, it was like, oh my God, this is like radical, right? Because up until then, I firmly believed that no matter what was arising in my mind, I had to just stick with it. Because that's what's taught, especially to beginners, when they're being taught mindfulness. It's like, no matter what it is, you got to hang in there with this stuff. Stick with it, stick with it, stick with it. And at a certain point, I mean, what Joseph said was, if you've actually had the same thought five times, and you really consciously, deeply looked at the story five times, then to look at it the sixth time is just a waste of your time. Time to change the channel, which is seems like exactly the opposite of all the other instructions that we hear. But it's important that we, and I'll talk more about this, that there's somehow this balance we have to find between just wallowing in this same old story yet again, or stepping out and shifting and changing the channel. So this is from the sutta. Here, bhikkhus, when a bhikkhu is giving attention to some sign, something arising in the mind, and owing to that sign there arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, he should give attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome. Change the channel. Just shift from something that's unwholesome to something that's wholesome. Just change. And what a radical idea. Like, okay, I'm having this story about this person in my past, perhaps. And it's just like the usual rant I go on about this happened and that happened and blah, blah, blah. Like I was having with that woman who was coughing all the time. And all I did was change the channel. I consciously chose to change the channel and not be caught up in judgment and anger and frustration and distraction, but just try to have this open-hearted feeling of compassion towards her. And it was just like all that judgment just went away, was gone. Because I just stopped paying attention to the coughing and paid attention to this feeling of loving kindness and compassion in my heart instead. Just shifted the channel. Now my thoughts about her were totally different than they had been. And that's actually one very skillful way to do this. That is, if this one I find metta very useful. When I'm caught up in some story about someone, because most of these stories are about someone. Like sometimes, even if it's just a story about ourselves and how, oh God, how could I have been so stupid to have done that, blah, 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 and we're beating ourselves up. Well, metta for self is a very skillful practice. And just the shift away from that story with all the thoughts of ill will towards that person to thoughts of metta or compassion in that particular case can be very skillful. Just, all right, so for a couple of minutes now, I'm actually going to consciously do set of mindfulness practice. I'm going to do metta practice. Just blend it right into the sit. Or I'm actually consciously holding the person in my heart, mind, and wishing them well. Even sometimes I actually use the formal phrases for metta to do this. It just can change everything, just like that. So the example, I love the Buddha gives examples for all of these things that are very sort of down to earth so people would understand it. Just as a skilled carpenter or his apprentice might knock out, remove, and extract a coarse peg by means of a fine one. This is, you know, post and beam construction. They would actually hold beams together with a peg that they would drill through the holes. And they'd start with something coarse, and it would be sort of a bit shaky, and then eventually they'd use something fine, something better, and knock out the coarse peg with a finer peg. And that would make the structure solid. Instead of being shaky, it's now solid. Everybody in the Buddhist time would understand exactly what he's talking about. But then he says, here's the next verse. If, while he's giving attention to some other sign connected with what is wholesome, there still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should examine the danger of those thoughts thus. These thoughts are unwholesome, they are reprehensible, they result in suffering. So actually, think about the underlying energy of that thought that you're having, or those thoughts you're having, and see very clearly how they're unwholesome. So contemplation is actually being suggested, like a little bit of contemplation, like actually thinking about it. Oh yeah, these feelings of anger towards this person, I can feel how unwholesome they are. I understand how unwholesome they are. I love this example. Just as a man or a woman, young, youthful, and fond of ornament, would be horrified, humiliated, and disgusted if the carcass of a snake or a dog or a human being were hung around his or her neck. What a great image. Like, think of like maybe or an arc, it's like the carcass of a snake. So it's a dead snake hung around your neck. It's like, oh, that's what this is. This story is like a dead snake hung around my neck. What a great image. It's like, oh, like would we immediately be like, ugh, I don't need to go there anymore. This is really repulsive. Then the Buddha goes on. He says, if while examining the danger in these thoughts, there still arise in him unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, or with delusion, then he should try to forget those thoughts and should not give attention to them. Just look away. Sometimes that's what we need to do, is just, you know, look the other way. Just not go there. Just let them go. Whether they're thoughts or whether, I always think of this very visually, like, you know, you're walking along and you see something, it's like, whoa, and your mind starts to spin. Sometimes it's like the most skillful thing to do is simply just to look away, to not get caught, just not pay attention, let them go. Just as a man with good eyes who did not want to see forms that have come within range of sight, I would either shut his eyes or look away. Just shut those things out. No, don't need that. Thank you very much. Then the Buddha goes on. I mean, it keeps gets more interesting. If while he is trying to forget those thoughts and is not giving attention to them, there's still arise in him evil, unwholesome thoughts connected with desire, with hate, and with delusion, then he should give attention to stilling the thought formations of those thoughts. So there you are, your mind is spinning. It's full of busy, blah, 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 blah. Consciously choose to slow your mind down. So for me, this means in my mindfulness practice, just step back from that sort of wide open, noting whatever is arising space, to pure, just paying attention to the breath and nothing else. Like just noting the breath, just going into this sort of much more concentrated, focused form of practice. In fact, I found for me what works really well in these sort of situations is not only do I just drop back to the breath, but I start counting my breath, but counting it backwards from 10. So it's, you know, it's like you note in, you note out, 10. Note in, note out, 9. Until you get all the way down to 1, then you start again. It takes a lot of concentration to not lose track because, you know, what's going on is the mind is spinning with all this nonsense and you're trying to just concentrate and count your breath. It really just shifts the mind away from that story into this very concentrated state. Still perfectly good practice. Now I've just decided to have this quite narrow focus on the very beginning first instruction I ever got on mindfulness. Sometimes that's very skillful. That's a skillful choice to make. And then, you know, as the mind goes still, then you can sort of, okay, now let's open back up again. And you might have to go back and forth 3 or 4 times. Who knows? Depends what the story is and how strong it is and how you're doing that day. But it's perfectly, that's perfectly good practice. To just shift to a form of practice that's very deeply and simply concentrated. Mm-hmm. Here's the Buddha's example. Just as a man walking fast might consider, why am I walking fast? What if I walk slowly? And he would walk slowly. Then he would consider, why am I walking slowly? What if I stand? And he would stand. Then he might consider, what if I'm standing? Why am I standing? What if I sit? And he would sit. Then he would consider, why am I sitting? What if I lie down? And he would lie down. Slower, 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 simpler, simpler, simpler. It's a great image, this slowing down by actually lying down. Because that's really what we're doing. We're getting our mind to lie down and relax and not spin like walking fast through this story. Finally, we get to the last of these 5. And this is... I must say, be careful with this last one. This is not something you have to do very carefully and very consciously and don't resort to. This is like nothing else has worked. I've tried all these other things and still it's there. Then, with his teeth clenched and his tongue pressed against the roof of his mouth, he should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. Wow. Serious. Just as a strong man might seize a weaker man by the head or shoulders and beat him down, constrain him, and crush him. This is what we have to do sometimes. It's like, that's it. I've had it with this stupid story. No more. Beat it down. Yeah. With teeth clenched and tongue pressed against the roof of the mouth, like there's a little growl going on here. Right? He should beat down, constrain, and crush mind with mind. This is remember, a last resort. Nothing else, all the previous 4 possibilities didn't work. I've tried them all, and there it is. Pounding away that story still, that thought, that image, whatever it is, then sometimes we have to just knock it down, jump on it, stomp on it, whatever. Joseph Goldstein has this great story he tells about how when this happens for him, he imagined he's a cowboy with a gun and he's shooting the thought. And he keeps shooting it and shooting it and shooting it until it goes away. He calls it cowboy dharma, which I think is a great, pretty cool image, actually. I'm not a gun guy, so for me, it just makes me feel uncomfortable even thinking about it. But it's an interesting thought. So, the thing is, of course, that all of these instructions, this whole sutta, is basically saying, seemingly, the opposite of what we would call the normal instructions about mindfulness. But these are mindfulness instructions. Very, very clearly, these are mindfulness instructions. So, how do you choose what to do? How do you choose which of these solutions, the RAIN solution, which is can be very skillful and work really well, or these more forceful solutions? So the first few aren't particularly forceful. Replacing an unwholesome thought with a wholesome thought is not forceful at all. It isn't mindfulness in the sense of it's not paying attention to the present moment anymore. I'm trying to consciously change the present moment, trying to change the channel. I'm reaching out and flicking that switch. So I'm not just taking in what's arising. And the only thing I can say about how do you choose is you got to figure this out for yourself. We all have to find what works for us. Some of these five instructions work better for me than others. Just looking away for me just goes, doesn't work. But the very first one has been very effective for me many times. And the fourth one, the dropping down into a very concentrated, simple practice. It's also been very skillful for me sometimes. So we find what works. And we're very careful not to just start using these techniques, these skillful means, as a way to avoid, as a way to, I don't like this kind of story, so I'm gonna crush it instead. don't let this become aversive technique number 37, and just being totally caught up in aversion about these things. We have to find that balance between them. And everyone has to sort of work with this. And this is where I think mindfulness becomes really skillful. I mean, there's a certain amount of skill in, noting and paying attention to what's arising in the moment, but then consciously in the midst of a sitting period or in the midst of a long retreat, because sometimes this is a repeated process, you go, okay, that's it. And you shift. You consciously choose to shift. This is a skill that's extremely valuable as part of this practice. And it's something you have to sort of learn how to do just by trying it out and seeing what happens. But it is definitely part of the whole mindfulness system as taught by the Buddha. I mean, this is like a whole sutta. This is a very famous sutta, by the way. This is like, everybody talks about this sutta. This is like a classic. And it's tricky because how do we find that balance? You only find it by practicing. And I mean, sometimes you're going to go to one extreme or the other, and it's not going to be very pleasant, and it's going to be difficult. Then you start again. I mean, that's the other thing about this practice is we just keep starting again. Every morning I sit down, I'm starting again. It's never, never easy. And I just start again. And I start again. That turned out to be not very skillful, I can say to myself sometimes. I'll try a different method next time. See how that works. But you have to be willing to look at your practice not as a set of rules, but as an experiment. Constantly experimenting, seeing what works, seeing if I shift it this way or that way. Oh, look at that. Isn't this interesting? Look how much clearer and calmer my mind is now, because I consciously chose at this point to shift to this form as opposed to that form. There's a little, I guess this is a poem. You're familiar with the poet Hafiz, it's a Sufi poet who I have great love for. And he has a really simple two-line poem about what I've been talking about. It says, "Who would want to live with some crickets in your room carousing loudly all night? That is to say, either befriend all your thoughts, party with them as best you can, or throw the rascals out." Great advice. I mean, Hafiz just really does it, it's sort of tongue-in-cheek almost when he says these things. But I'm going to read this again. "Who would want to live with some crickets in your room carousing loudly all night? That is to say, either befriend all your thoughts, party with them as best you can, or throw the rascals out." Wonderful advice, which really sums up everything I've been saying. You know, the rain method is definitely partying with them. You know, befriending these unwholesome, unpleasant stories. And making them like, "Oh, yeah, I know you. Yeah. Nice to see you again, but we're not going to get caught in this story. I'm just going to open to it, accept it, and be okay with it." Or throw the rascals out. Go through one of these five things suggested in the sutta that are also skillful means. So finally, I want to read this poem, as I always have to do, from Dana Fald's book, Going and In, which once again talks about this very topic. It's called "The Fruits of Practice." Despite fervent pleas for ease and safety, there are many days when reality doesn't quite line up with what I'd choose. Breakdown, letting go, surrendering even the illusion of control, breathing into the unknown. Sometimes that is what life holds. Practice hasn't been an end to pain. There's a good one, right? Practice hasn't been an end to pain. I still increase my suffering like a fish caught on a line. My struggles only draw the hook in deeper. But being in reality is its own reward. It's the perfect paradox. The courage to stand and breathe when everything in me wants to flee is as great a gift as the freedom to seek retreat. No practice hasn't brought an end to pain, but it has honed my willingness to experience the moment and sometimes to see perfection unfolding in ways I wasn't big enough to plan, much less predict. Practice isn't about achieving a goal. It's not a means to pole vault over suffering. Practice is the way of looking life in the face and saying yes to all its disparate gifts. Practice keeps me awake when I would sleep and reminds me it's the journey unfolding in this very moment. It's the journey that reveals the truth, not the destination. Wonderful advice again. So that's my Dharma talk for tonight. So I'm going to, as I always do, ask you all to unmute yourself if you want to. Share anything you have to say, ask any questions. I also, any feedback you have just in a more general sense about what I've been doing over the last 20 weeks, which is, I think about, oh my God, I've been doing this for 20 weeks. anything you'd like me to do? Are there topics I haven't covered that I should cover sometime soon? And it doesn't have to be tonight. You can send me an email if you want. It'd be nice if you would talk about this or that or some area that I haven't touched on. And if I feel capable of doing that, I will. I mean, there's some things I'm careful to speak about still. Not too much anymore, but it's always things I don't know enough to talk about, I suppose. So comments, questions, thoughts, I've exhausted you all. You're waving, Deborah?
Yes, I'm waving.
Okay, go ahead.
I can't believe it's been 20 weeks. I bet this is my third course with you. Is that how
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it's been interesting for me too to be this consistently teaching every week. It's something I've never done before.
Oh.
I've taught every other week. I've taught once a month. I've taught, doing retreats on a day-long retreats and longer retreats, but never every week. It's a very different thing, which has been really good for me to do because it means I have to be very organized and get it together. And I have plans now for up till Christmas time in my mind.
Great.
What I'm going
to
do.
I'm looking forward to the next one.
Yeah, so I'm going to take, like I say, next week I'm taking off. Thank you for your kind comments. 20 weeks, yeah, it's amazing, huh? Just like, but that's like part of this whole COVID-19 thing. It's like all of a sudden, time, where'd all that time go? Where did all those weeks go that I thought I was going to be doing other things and going on vacation and doing all the things I normally do in the summer? And, well, I've done a lot of bike riding and hiking and walking, so it's been good, but it's been very different than what I normally would do in the summer. Great garden this year. Just good. Other thoughts, comments, questions?
Thank you, Barry. This was very helpful.
Oh, hi, Julie. One of these days you have to can you not put your picture up? Your phone won't let you?
Or you just... I'll have to do that. Yeah.
Be bold so I can see your smiling face sometime, Julie.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be today, but just think about it. To be honest with you, it helps me to see people's faces because I can see their reactions to what I'm saying, and makes it a little more, I can connect in that way with people.
Okay.
Because this electronic world is kind of difficult sometimes because you don't see that. Like, it's not like sitting in a room, you can feel the energy of the room. It's different. So it's helpful. It's okay. You can turn it off again now. Thank you. but you know what I'm saying? It's like, for me, it's really helpful if people, at least sometimes. I mean, I know sometimes people are in their jammies and they don't want to have their ritual. And that's okay, too.
You know, you don't have to brush your teeth in the morning to join a meditation group.
Yeah. Right.
Thank
you. Okay. Anyhow, so let's finish by just having a dedication of merit.